Good morning. On today's programme, the efforts being made to end female genital mutilation in Cameroon and the surprises to emerge from Turkey's local elections. But first, we go to Slovakia, which has been dealing with a spate of high-profile bear attacks recently. The problem of bears and what to do with them even became a political issue ahead of this weekend's presidential election. Indeed, as Rob Cameron reports now from Prague in the neighbouring Czech Republic, some Slovaks accuse politicians of exploiting the issue for their own ends.
The video is remarkable. It's Sunday, March the 17th, on a sunny afternoon in the northern Slovak town of Liptovský Mikuláš. The town sits on the river Vach, just north of the mountainous Low Tatra National Park, and it's fair to describe it as sleepy. Anyway, the video is shot from the back of a car. A group of what sounds like young Slovaks watches in amazement as a huge brown bear bounds past them on the road. The bear lopes off down the street and disappears. The man holding the camera is beside himself with amusement. The audio is peppered with Slovak swear words, which were unrepeatable when I first had to translate them and are unrepeatable now. More videos quickly surfaced and spread like wildfire on social media. In one, shot from a distance, the bear bounds along the pavement as a man strolls along towards it. At some point, there's a blur of fur as the two meet, although the man quickly leaps over a fence. And not long afterwards, the first reports of injuries appear. Five people are treated for cuts, gashes and shock, including a 10-year-old girl. All are quickly released from hospital, but this incident is clearly not just an amusing social media story. People have been hurt by a rampaging wild animal in broad daylight. The authorities responded quickly. A state of emergency was introduced not just in Liptovský Mikuláš, but in other towns and regions across Slovakia near areas of forest and mountains known to have bear populations. The populist nationalist government uttered dark threats of watering down European wildlife protections to allow Slovakia to cull what it said was an excessive number of bears. And then, 10 days later, an announcement from the Environment Minister on Facebook that the bear was dead, tracked with a drone using biometric technology and shot by a special team in forest about 7 kilometres from Liptovský Mikuláš. But did they shoot the right bear? At least one opposition MEP said no. On the phone, he told me he'd seen photos of documents, apparently from the hunt, scattered by the side of the road, proving, he said, that this bear they shot was a different bear, a female bear, not a male bear, and about a third smaller. I'm certain it's not the same bear, he said, adding that the whole situation was almost comically absurd. And since then, there have been more encounters, two over Easter weekend and another on Thursday, this one again near Liptovský Mikuláš. Could it have been the same bear? The government seems less than keen on engaging on that question, but certainly the issue was raised ahead of this weekend's presidential election. Robert Fico's populist government submitted a bill last week which would give greater legal protection for the shooting of bears that stray too close or even into inhabited areas. A cynical ploy, say the opposition, as the Environment Ministry would still need to grant an exception to allow each shoot so nothing would change. And what of the government's claim that there are now too many bears in Slovakia? Certainly better environmental protection in Central and Eastern Europe since the fall of communism in 1989 has meant bears and wolves have returned to their natural habitats across the Carpathian mountain range, which stretches up from Romania through Western Ukraine and on to Slovakia and Poland. But researchers say there has been no explosion in Slovakia's estimated bear population, which, they say, remains stable at around 1,275. Meaning, if you do go down to the woods today, you're actually extremely unlikely to be sure of a big surprise. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Next to Cameroon, where thousands of women and girls are subjected to FGM or female genital mutilation, in the far north of the country, aid agencies are encouraging female cutters to abandon the practice and are providing alternative jobs for these women. From Cameroon, Dorcas Ikupe has sent this report.
Female genital mutilation, also known as cutting or circumcision, is punishable and criminal according to the Cameroon Penal Code since 2016. Sadly, the practice still persists in some parts of the Central African nation. In the far north of the country, which has the highest rates of FGM, aid groups and human rights activists are working tirelessly to dissuade women to abandon the nefarious practice. One of the groups helping female cutters to abandon the practice is a local non-governmental organization known as Local Action for Participative Development, better known in its French acronym as ALDEPA. The NGO uses regular information campaigns and field visits and has helped more than 50 women to successfully abandon the practice. One of them, who has successfully stopped cutting young girls, is a 50-year-old woman who prefers anonymity. She says she has cut girls for 15 years. According to this woman, FGM was a noble cultural practice to uphold, and she knew she was doing something right. Now repentant of her past deeds, she says she feels sorry and ashamed for the act committed to many young girls. She explains that ALDEPA approached them and opened their eyes on how harmful the practice was. The female cutters were told of the dangers of FGM and the trauma the practice was bringing to girls, like obstetric fistula, leading to serious health complications, infections, chronic pain, and even depression. The middle-aged woman says they heeded to the advice of the aid group and have finally stopped the practice. She says she did what she did out of ignorance, and after they realized their errors, they stopped cutting the girls a few years ago. She also says that ALDEPA helped them financially, and she now works as a seamstress and owns her own tailoring shop where she sews and sells dresses. This business has been sustaining her financially for years now. Magwen is another former cutter who, just like the 50-year-old woman, has been cutting girls for several years. These women are now championing the fight against female genital mutilation as they now travel to neighboring countries like Chad to educate other female cutters. Magwen says she is now enlightened and can't return to her dark days. Some former victims say female genital mutilation should never be experienced by others. 30-year-old Bello says she was 8 when she was forced to undergo female genital mutilation. She recounts that she cried all the way through and bled for several days, and she is grateful she didn't die in the process. For Fadimatu, who was caught at a young age, she recalls how it happened. She says she was excited to go for holidays in the village with her cousins, but little did she know what was ahead of her. She says she was circumcised against her will, then her mom told her she's now a woman. It was later at age 16 that she says she realized it was female genital mutilation that was practiced on her. Years later, she forgave her mother. Marth Wando, national coordinator of the NGO ALDEPA, says helping women and young girls who have been survivors of female genital mutilation is what motivates her. She says the road and work has been tedious and a difficult one, but the impact keeps her going. Wando says over 50 former female cutters have successfully abandoned the practice thanks to efforts from her NGO. This multiple award-winning human rights advocate says it wasn't easy for her team to convince these women to stop the practice. She told World Report that victims of female genital mutilation have been offered psychosocial care. Math adds that they work on women and children's rights, and they know that sexual and gender-based violence has negative impacts on girls. The high-profile human rights campaigner says FGM is one of the worst forms of sexual and gender-based violence because women and girls lose one of their body parts, and it touches on one's dignity when a girl is mutilated. For World Report, I'm Dorcas Ikupe in Mara, Cameroon.
Finally, we go to Turkey. This time last Sunday, Turks were voting in local elections. The polls produced several surprises. A small right-wing party came from nowhere to take 6% of the vote. A centrist party lost half of its support. The elections turned on what happened in Istanbul, where President Erdogan campaigned hard for the city he used to run. Jasper Mortimer reports from Istanbul.
Last month, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told Turks that the local elections which took place a week ago would be his last. Liberal Turks were pleased, and they hoped he would stick to his promise. There are fears that he plans to change the constitution to enable him to run in 2028. Conservative Turks saw the comment for what it was, an appeal to voters to give him a good result, a fitting send-off for a man who has dominated politics for more than 20 years. The satirical magazine L'Aman published a cartoon on its cover. Erdogan is canvassing on a street, dressed warmly in an overcoat, coloured blue, his favourite colour. As two men walk by, he tells them, "This is my last election." The men are on their last legs. Their clothes are decrepit, their shoes falling apart, and there is hunger in their eyes. One of them replies, "May this not be our last election." The cartoon appeared 10 days before the polls, and it was prescient. Last Sunday, Turks voted heavily. 79% of them voted, and they voted heavily against Erdogan. For the first time since his AK Party came to power in 2002, the main opposition party won more votes. The Republican People's Party, known by its acronym CHP, got nearly 38% of the national vote. The AK Party got 35.5%. The CHP won the race for mayor in Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir. These are the three biggest cities in the country, and together they account for almost a third of Turkey's 85 million people. Of the three, the jewel is Istanbul, and it was there that the race was expected to be closest. A city of 16 million people, Istanbul is the financial capital of Turkey and the home to its elite. The city is particularly important to Erdogan because he was born there and he served as mayor in the 1990s. The president pulled out the stops to retake Istanbul, having lost it to the CHP's Ekrem İmamoğlu in 2019. As usual, state television devoted far more hours to covering the AK Party candidate, Murat Kurum, than to covering İmamoğlu. Cabinet ministers came from Ankara to campaign for Kurum, a former minister of environment. İmamoğlu, on the other hand, reached out to the city's Kurds, 10% of the electorate. He published his propaganda in Kurdish, an exceptional move for a mainstream party. When the votes were counted on Sunday night, İmamoğlu had won by 51% to Kurum's 40%. Thousands of CHP supporters rallied outside the city council's offices, dancing, singing Ataturkist songs, and waving red and white flags. In Ankara, Erdogan, looking more reserved than usual, said, "Unfortunately, we did not get the result we wanted. The election was a turning point. We will correct our mistakes and eliminate our deficiencies." Ekrem İmamoğlu deserved to win, as he has been a good mayor. He has almost doubled the city's metro lines. He has restored historic buildings and established public libraries in every district. But the question that analysts had to answer was what explained the turnaround from the general elections of last year. In May last year, Erdogan's AK Party had won parliament by 36% to the CHP's 25%. How could one explain the CHP's rising from 25 to 38% in only 10 months? Commentators said this time people voted according to the issues, rather than which leader they identified with. And the issue in these elections was the state of the economy. Inflation was officially 67%, unofficially more than 120%. The lowest pension was lower than the minimum wage. The columnist Murat Yetkin said Erdogan had paid the price for underestimating the backlash from pensioners and workers. The Leman cartoon had expressed that the economy was hurting people, and the president was on a completely different plane. There was something else that was gratifying to liberal Turks. Under Erdogan, Turkey has moved towards authoritarianism. The EU criticizes the political control of the media and of the courts, and the imprisonment of opposition such as Selahattin Demirtas and Osman Kavala. But last week's results showed that for all that has happened, Turkey can still hold elections that produce surprises. that deliver a shock to the head of government. Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Istanbul.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.